continue.
No, it's the same. It's just a new edition, but you know, I noticed there's some mistakes in here. And I didn't notice any in this one. I mean, like, they first printed 1957, 1970, 1973, 1974, 1975, 1988, 1992, 1993, 1994, 2000, 2002, 2005, 2013, 2018. It was gotta be 2018.
It was 20 bucks.
That's ridiculous, because printed in India probably cost like 50 rupees or something.
Yeah. You got it in India?
No, I got it here. I got it from Amazon.
Well, this one comes...
There is nipple in the air outside. It's 48 degrees.
That's very cold.
This one costs 3 rupees.
Back in the day, this is very old.
You know, show these Arthur Osborne's. So now he's going to get into some philosophy or something, which he likes to do. Arthur Osborne, you know, he has Christianity and Hinduism. There's Hinduism and Islam. Sai Baba sometimes spoke of himself as a reincarnation of Kabir, the poet saint of the late 15th and early 16th century, who had both Hindu and Muslim disciples and taught each in the terms of their own religion. This is what he himself did. In his own behavior, he did not conform fully to either. He made his abode in the Shirdi Mosque and generally used the Islamic name for God. And when he was heard to repeat mantras or sacred phrases, they were Islamic, not Hindu. However, he very seldom said the ritualistic Islamic daily prayers. Some devotees never saw him do so. Others report that he occasionally did on Saturdays or on some special occasion. Why Saturdays? Is one of the puzzles of Sai Baba. Since it is Friday that is the day for corporate prayer among the Muslims. He was a vegetarian, like his Hindu followers, and was worshipped by them in Hindu fashion. He also referred frequently to his Hindu guru and to Hindu scriptures and gods. That is, forms and aspects of God. He did not, however, encourage a merging of the two paths among his followers. He expected goodwill and tolerance between them. That was all. Although he did not say namaz, the daily prayers, he expected his Muslim followers to do so. Also, both religions being valid, he did not approve of conversion from one to another, but expected each person to strive in that in which he had been brought up. A Hindu who had been converted to Islam once came to the mosque and Sai Baba slapped his face, exclaiming, "So you have got yourself a new father." As a sign of goodwill, he liked his Hindu and Muslim followers to rejoice in one another's festivities, as as had long been the custom in India, though of course without actually participating in the worship. So for instance, a Hindu devotee tells how there would be a procession on the birth anniversary of Sri Rama, after which the Hindus would sing sacred songs, interspersed by Muslim reading of the Quran. Sometimes also the Muslims would take out a procession bearing the shoes of Sai Baba on a cushion before them, so as to avoid anthropomorphism or representational worship, and the Hindus would accompany them. Apart even from any specific teaching, the mere influence of Sai Baba's presence led to goodwill and tolerance. The following story by a Pathan Muslim called Abdullah illustrates this. When they say Pathan.
Pathan. Yeah, the Afghans and all are Pathans.
Pathans, warriors?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they speak a different language, Pashtun. Mm-hmm.
I left my house, my hometown in Tarbela, when I was still a boy. I had no one to look after me. I wanted to go abroad and see Mecca and other places. I traveled south as far as Mandmad, where someone took an interest in me and told me that I could easily make my way to Bombay, and from there get a passage to Mecca. Someone else, however, told me that there was a great man called Sai Baba at Shirdi who showered money on fakirs and would send me to Mecca if I wanted. So I went to Shirdi. As I entered the gate of the mosque, Sai Baba was standing there before me. Our eyes met and I felt at once that he was my guru. I stayed on at Shirdi. You know, do Muslims say guru?
No.
They don't.
No.
No.
So he must
imam.
Have been,
what?
Imam is like the priest. Like the priest at the moment.
Yeah. Allah.
So he must have been influenced by these Hindus, you know, he used to
already.
Our eyes met and I felt at once that he was my guru. I stayed on at Shirdi. He fed me and other fakirs abundantly, and I decided to stay there and lead an easy life. This was in 1913, when I was still quite young, and I had not begun to take life seriously. Nevertheless, my stay with Sai Baba brought about a marked change to my attitude of mind. When I first came to Shirdi, I looked upon Hindus as my enemies, but after I had been about 3 years with Sai Baba, this feeling of animosity passed away, and I began to regard them as brothers. Unquote. Naturally, there was not always goodwill or understanding. It was the Hindus' worship of Sai Baba that was the stumbling block for Muslims. And the performance of this worship in a mosque seemed to be adding insult to injury.
The worship of him they objected to.
Yeah. You know, even Muhammad said, like in his deathbed, those Jews and who else? I don't know, he didn't say Hindus.
Christians?
Those Jews and Christians worshiping the tombs of dead people. Damn them or something, you know?
Yeah,
Muhammad, damn them, you know, worshipping the tombs of dead people. Yeah.
He said he was hallucinating.
Yeah, then what? He goes into the cave and says he saw Allah. Come on. They were in, when you go to Israel, they take you there.
Yeah.
Where Muhammad.
Well, they don't worship his mosque, or, you know, where he was buried, you know, he was just, still, they don't, no one goes there.
They don't believe in worshiping anything.
No.
They don't believe in worship anything.
So there's two, you know, the ones one of the two different sects of Muslims.
Sunni and Shia. Shia. Uh-huh.
So the Sunnis,
Sunni.
They won't worship. They're very adamant against it. But the Shias will sometimes do it. You know, even Sunnis will do it. This is what Dinesh told me. You know, he's in Oman and he works for the Prince of Saudi Arabia there. He said sometimes they'll secretly go.
Secretly,
you know, there's some shrine of some saint. They won't.
In Oman, there are two temples: one Shiva temple and one Krishna temple.
Where? In Oman. Yeah, I've been.
Yeah.
They have even Sai Baba temple. They have in Oman.
Now they have built one, right. And Dubai has temples.
Mm.
Yeah.
And that Sheikh of Oman gave property to build a temple. But it's out of town. Yeah. It's out of town. No one wants to go there. It's way out, you know. But
apparently, he was protected during the war by this couple.
By these merchants, Hindu merchants.
Yeah.
In Oman. Islam expresses the point of view that God alone is to be worshipped, and that the whole universe was evoked by Him out of nothingness, and all men are as nothing before Him. Hinduism expresses the point of view that the universe with all its beings is a form assumed by Him, a manifestation of Him, without, however, changing or detracting from His unmanifested reality. To say that God created the universe out of nothing, or that the universe is nothing but an illusion veiling the reality of God, comes to the same. The two points of view are therefore two aspects of the same truth, two ways of saying the same thing. Since a man has no reality other than that given by God, the essence of his being, the reality of him, must be that reality other than which there is nothing, that is to say, God. By realizing the nothingness of his individuality, by what was called in medieval Christendom, self-naughting, a man realizes the universality of his divine essence. Therefore, a man who has realized his true self, which has nothing to do with psychology, but goes beyond the mind to the very essence of being, and is without doubt the true meaning of the Delphic, know thyself, has realized his essential oneness with God. I and my Father are one. Beyond the accident of form. Appreciating this, Hindus worship such a one as God. Adhering to the letter of the law, most Muslims condemn such worship as idolatry. Actually, it is not. It is not worshiping other than God, but, on the contrary, recognizing that the worshipped has destroyed the illusion of otherness from God, which still veils the worshipper. I was trying to explain all this. All this is understood by the Sufis, who are the spiritual elect of Islam.
Yes, Sufis are mystics.
Yeah, so it was banned in Afghanistan, you know. Mm-hmm. They used to even execute them.
Yeah.
You know? But they teach in secret what the Hindus teach openly. But the exoteric Muslims do not understand. For them, there is an absolute gulf between the two viewpoints. And for them, the Hindus are pantheists, or idolaters. The Sufi poet Al-Hallaj used to proclaim, when in a state of ecstasy, "An al-haq, I am the truth." The truth is a divine name, and he was executed for blasphemy in accordance with Islamic law. Although the Sufis understood, and I have continued to revere him. Another Sufi, Abu Sa'id, skirted the law, declaring negatively, "There is nothing beneath this robe other than Allah." A Sufi incantation used commonly to this day runs, I seek pardon of God for all in me that is not God. The Hindu worship of Sai Baba started very simply in 1908 with a child homage to him. The Hindu lady tells the story. My brother, Bappu Rao, who was then a child of four, used to go every morning and put a flower on Sai Baba's head and worship him. Just 4 years old, you know. That was the beginning of the regular worship of Baba, as he had not permitted others to do it before that. You know, it was just,
he was
just child playing, you know, he went along with the child play. But then he got stuck. The child was simply honoring Sai Baba as he had seen idols honored in temple worship. And from that time, the practice grew up of doing full ritualistic worship as to an idol. An intelligent Hindu does not believe that an idol is God any more than an intelligent Catholic believes that a holy picture or a statue of a saint is God. Few people are capable of conceiving of the formless absolute. Are the critics of idolatry. And the ordinary Hindu makes worship easier by concentrating on the manifestation of God in a certain form and aspect characterized by a certain picture or statue. He may be led thereby in due course to realization of the formless, whether in this life or beyond it. It is said in the Gita, whatever form a man worships, he really worships me. Or as ritualistic worship with flowers and sandal paste is performed for an idol, so also it is for one who is felt to be more than a saint, one who has realized his identity with Supreme Being and is therefore a conscious manifestation of God. Not all Muslims at Shirdi could appreciate this, especially when the worship took place in a mosque. The result was that Muslim followers came to be far outnumbered by the Hindus. Occasionally, also, there were protests. One Rohilla Muslim, that's another place, Rohilla. One Rohilla Muslim who was constantly with Sai Baba and would sit and read the Quran at his feet at night, protested against allowing the midday Hindu worship with its music in the mosque. Baba only smiled and said, all that is Allah. Puzzled over it as he would, it seemed to the poor man that Sai Baba was betraying Islam, and he decided that he must make retribution. One day when Sai Baba was out walking, he came up behind him with a club, intending to strike him down. Sai Baba turned just at that moment, touched his left wrist, and looked at him. Under the force of his gaze, he sank to the ground, powerless to lift the club or even to rise. Someone came and helped him up. A few days later, he went and took leave of Sai Baba and, with his blessing, left Shirdi for good. On another occasion, a Muslim follower, Mir Jaman, sprang up suddenly at night and, drawing his sword, declared that the Hindus were spoiling Sai Baba by worshipping him and asked permission to cut their throats. Yeah, sure. Sai Baba pacified him, saying, it is I who am mad, and I'm responsible for their worshipping me. So if you want to cut any throats, you must begin with mine. To the Hindus, tolerance comes far easier. Their religion itself recognizes many forms of doctrine and ways of approach to God, not conflicting like Muslim or Christian sects. but recognizing each other as legitimate and suited to various temperaments and levels of understanding. They find it easier, therefore, to recognize the path afforded in other religions. Hindu devotees worshipped the divine man in Sai Baba, and if Muslims did not, that was their concern. There were, of course, bigoted Hindus as well as Muslims, but their bigotry took a milder form. It injured only themselves, being expressed simply as refusal to worship a Muslim guru. Cases of such prejudice have been quoted already and of how they were overcome. The following story, like that of the Muslim Abdullah, quoted above, illustrates the silent influence. The deputy collector, H.V. Sate, met a devout but simple-minded Brahmin called Megha, in whom he took an interest. He had him instructed in mantrams and sent him to broach to worship Shiva there. After some time he told him that Sai Baba was Shiva incarnate and sent him to Shirdi to worship him. Megha, however, heard at the railway station that Baba was a Muslim, and horrified at the idea of prostrating himself before a Muslim, begged to be excused from going there. Sate insisted. So he made the journey, albeit reluctantly. Before ever he reached the mosque, Sai Baba shouted angrily, "Throw that scoundrel out!" and chased him away. He also turned angrily on Sate and berated him for sending such a crude and narrow person. That was outwardly, but inwardly the influence began working. A year or so later, Megha felt genuinely drawn to Shirdi. And this time he was not driven away but entered the mosque and stayed there. As with Abdullah, the interchange took place without verbal instruction. He served Sai Baba and conducted worship there daily. And when he died, Sai Baba said, "This was a true devotee of mine." More and more, the Hindus predominated. Even the renovation of the mosque was carried out by them. When Sai Baba first took up his abode there, it was a dilapidated mud structure with walls only 8 feet high by 14 feet long, running round three sides, while the east side stood open to wind and rain. About half the roof had caved in, and the rest was sagging and liable to fall. Have you gone there?
Shirdi, yes.
Yeah. So it must be built up quite a bit. Right?
Yeah, now it is really become big. And, you know, you can go from anywhere. The Volvo bus takes you right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From Bombay or?
Yeah. Even from Pune. Bangalore too. Direct. Really become very popular now.
Yeah, in the world he's the most popular guru. Everywhere you
and
see,
that,
all these
still that fire is burning, what he had lit in that time, still it is there.
Sai Baba could not be persuaded to live anywhere else, though his devotees would gladly have built a house or temple for him. So they decided to rebuild the mosque. Several times they asked permission, but he refused. Finally, one of them, G.R. Gundu, a revenue inspector who had obtained a son through Sai Baba's blessing, brought cartloads of stone and dumped them in front of the mosque, declaring that he was going to start work on it. Sai Baba told him to take the stones away and use them to renovate the local Hindu temples, but he did not. Finally, Baba allowed himself to be persuaded, and the work began. Even then, he interfered constantly, and often pulled down what had been done. It was only at night that steady, uninterrupted work could be done. And not every night either. He used to sleep alternate nights in the mosque and in the guest house. And his nights and the latter were the time for work. He insisted on proper Islamic architecture with minarets and a minbar or recess in the west wall, that is the wall facing Mecca, and steps supporting lamps. However, he also had a duni, or fireplace, where a perpetual fire was kept burning. Over against this, he had a seat made for himself with a low balustrade to lean onto. The mosque was thus a mixture of orthodoxy and innovation. He used to refer to it as a Brahmin mosque, though this did not necessarily mean Hindu, since he used the word Brahmin in its correct sense of spiritual elect. In the center of the yard outside the mosque, he had a Tulsi Brindaban constructed, that is a masonry block about 3 feet high containing a Tulsi plant, sacred to the Hindus, for them to circumambulate according to tradition. Inside the mosque were grinding stones, and Sai Baba used to spend much of his time grinding wheat into flour. This seemed to be one of his symbolical occupations, though he would bake a sort of cake with the flour in an oven outside the mosque and distribute it freely. He also kept mud pots in the mosque, or just outside it, from which he used to pour water, as described in a previous chapter, and others in which he used to put the food he begged. This was kept outside the mosque, and the sweeper woman, the lowest of the caste, was allowed to take what she liked out of it before he ate, as also were dogs, crows, or anyone who came. Symbols and powers. Symbolism is not an invention of any religion or teacher, but a recognition of correspondence that do in fact exist between the physical universe and spiritual reality. The world actually is a reflection of higher reality. And therefore the symbols only have to be recognized, not invented. That is the meaning of the Hermetic dictum, as above, so below. When Christ speaks of a man being born again, or a church speaks of the spouse of Christ, the symbolism is too evident to need explanation. It is said in the Quran, in the creation of the heavens and earth, and the alternation of night and day, and the ships that ply the sea with profit for men, and the rain that God sent down from heaven, therewith reviving the earth after it is dead, and his scattering abroad in it all manner of beasts, and the turning about of the winds and clouds driven between heaven and earth, surely there are signs for people who understand. To illustrate just one point from this passage, the falling of rain on barren land is a natural equivalent of the descent of grace on a barren heart, awakening stirrings of spiritual life. And the direct path of Advaita symbolism may be less in use, because the universe is rather negated than interpreted. But its existence is recognized, and another path it is extensively developed. Nevertheless, though all teachers use symbolism, it can be said that Sai Baba was peculiarly addicted to it. There was something secret and mysterious about his teaching. He used to get these coins and rub them together, even wear them down, these two coins, all these things. He used to do strange things like that. There was something secret and mysterious about his teaching. Material benefits were conferred openly in the miracles he performed, but spiritual guidance was more concealed. Also, as had been remarked in earlier chapters, he frequently taught in actions where another might in words. For instance, whereas Christ said, "Inasmuch as you do it to one of the least of these, you do it also to me." Sai Baba did not say it, but illustrated it. The lady once asked him to come and take food with her, and he consented. As may be imagined, she prepared special dishes with all the love and skill she had. She gave a gasp of horror when she saw a stray dog making for the food just before everything was ready. However, she drove it away in time and went to invite Sai Baba. "No," he said, "you drove me away when I wanted it. Now I won't. Now I don't want it." Even in trivial matters, he spoke symbolically. A lady describes her first visit when she was about 18. A devotee's spectacles fell off as he was bowing down, and someone suggested that as they had fallen at Sai Baba's feet, they should be presented to him. He immediately retorted, "I don't need spectacles. I've got a pair. They cost 40 rupees." Everyone knew that he did not wear spectacles. The lady who told the story was puzzled until her father explained to her that by spectacles he meant sight or realization, and by 40 rupees, the 40 years since he had attained realization. He often spoke symbolically in performing cures, or as in the case when he gave a devotee 4 mangoes in token of children he would have, and then added symbolism to symbolism by saying, "Eat and die." I mean, that, they explained that earlier. You know, when you give birth to someone, it's like you dying, because that's going to replace you at some point. One Despande, a devotee who had been mentioned already, was bitten by a snake and, in his terror, rushed straight to the mosque. When he reached the steps, however, Baba shouted, "Don't come up, Brahmin. Go back. Get down." Even in his fear of death, he did not dare disobey Sai Baba, but stood there in mute supplication. A moment later, Baba spoke again, this time in a gentle, kindly voice. "Come up now. The fakir is gracious to you. You will recover." The fakir, as already explained, was Sai Baba's way of referring to God. Despande now found that in the command not to come up, Baba had been speaking not to him, but to the poison which was entering his bloodstream. He would sometimes speak in parables, leaving his devotees to work out the answer. Quote, "Some robbers came and took away my money. I said nothing but quietly followed them and killed them, and so recovered my money." The money is the faculties natural to man in his pure state. To primordial man, or Adam, before the fall, the robbers are the desires. Killing them and recovering the wealth is destroying desires and realizing the self. Quote, "A man had a very fine house, but no matter what he did, it would not run in harness. An expert suggested that it should be taken back with a fine horse, An expert suggested that it should be taken back to the place whence it had come. This was done, and it became tractable and useful." Unquote. The horse is the ego. As the commander of the physical and mental powers of man, it is useful. But it is self-willed and therefore makes endless trouble. taking it back to its source is reabsorbing it in the spirit or self from which it arises. This is the same as Christ saying that a man must return to his mother's womb and be born again. It is the same as Bhagavan Ramana Maharshi's cryptic injunction to one who asked the way, go back the way you came. It is the return to the source which purifies and enlightens. From there the ego issues forth again, no longer an ego, but a conscious agent of the spirit. He said to a woman follower, the sky is cloudy, it will rain, the crop will grow and ripen, then the clouds will disperse. Why are you afraid? The overclouded sky is her present state of gloom and ignorance. The rain is a hardship and discomfort that she will undergo, but is also the divine grace that will ripen the seeds of spirituality in her heart, unknown to her, during the dark night of the soul. The dispersal of the clouds is the attainment of light and bliss when the seed has ripened. Haya Baba often gave cryptic replies, which would seem meaningless to one who did not understand. Someone wanted to take a photograph of him, and he replied, no! He is not to take a photograph. It is enough if he knocks the wall down. Well, who can understand that one? Meaningless, a photograph is the likeness of Sai Baba. The wall is the I am the body idea, which stands between a man and his identity with the spirit. It is enough to destroy that, and the true likeness of Sai Baba will appear. Not the body, but the spirit. Another peculiarity of Sai Baba was that instead of answering a question directly, he would sometimes refer the questioner to someone else or give him the answer indirectly. A case in point is quoted by Madhava Bao. He had thought, while sitting before Sai Baba, that the latter ought to explain to him the nature of one who is above the castes, that is, the natural orders of categories of men. Baba suddenly turned to him and bade him go and read scripture with Dixit. He did so and found Dixit reading a passage which contained the very explanation he desired. A number of other devotees have told similar stories, how they were sent to one person or another and found him just reading or speaking about the question that was disturbing them. In other ways, also, his instruction could be cryptic or hidden. Professor Narkay says he had the peculiar art of giving information to particular individuals in the midst of a group in a way that they alone could understand, and not the other members of the group. Strangely enough, at one at the same time he could and did benefit many people by few words or acts. None of this, of course, is exclusive to Sai Baba. In the ambience of a spiritual master, the meaningfulness of the universe is automatically heightened. Coincidences occur and signs appear. Nevertheless, all such things were apt to be more vivid and spectacular with Sai Baba than in other cases. Professor Narkay has said, to one deeply observing him, the startling fact came out into greater and greater prominence that Baba was living and operating in other worlds also besides this world and in an invisible body. Remarks made by him openly would be treated as meaningless, ranting, by those who did not know him. His language was also highly cryptic, full of symbology, parable, allegory, and metaphor. Of the cryptic speech, we have had examples enough. If someone asked permission to take a photograph and was told to knock a wall down, he might well think it meaningless ranting. With regards to powers also, Professor Narke was by no means alone in believing that Sai Baba had a power to guide the dead as well as the still embodied. There were those, too, who believed that he belonged to a hidden spiritual hierarchy and traveled at will in the subtle body. The village schoolmaster lived in the little mud-walled schoolroom just behind the mosque, and he reports often hearing conversation there at night in strange languages, not only Indian languages, but English also, of which Sai Baba knew nothing. Physically, he never left Shirdi, and yet when asked to go with devotees or to visit them, he might answer, "Yes, I will go with you. I don't need a train to travel by." Again, to quote the professor, Baba frequently spoke of his travels with an invisible body over great distances of space and time. Sitting near his fire in the morning with several devotees, he would say to what distant place he had been overnight and what he had done there. Those who had slept beside him all night at the mosque or rest house knew that his physical body had remained at Shirdi the whole night. But his statements were literally true and were sometimes verified and proved true. This power to travel in an invisible body to distant parts of this world, to traverse other realms than the earth life and control what takes place there and to see the past and future alike revealed one great fact about his nature. Some of his own observations also demonstrated it. I've heard him say, "Where am I? Where is this world?" I have seen him point to his body and say, "This is my house. I am not here. My guru has taken me away." As even in the flesh, in this earthly life, he was not confined to his physical body. It may truly be said of him that he is alive. He is where he was then. Even then, he was where he is now. Sai Baba never spoke untruth, never spoke meaningless jargon, but only those who were familiar with his ways could make out the meaning of what he said or did. That is when it was intended for their understanding. And now, two examples of Sai Baba's travels that is of the sort of travel that could be checked.